Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. We recently released bonus episodes on The Batman and Cyrano, and we have one in the works on the new Hulu limited series, The Dropout. Patrons also get access to ad-free versions of the podcast. But even if you aren't ready to subscribe, you can still follow the Patreon for your Next Picture Show bonus mini recommendations and Feedback Friday posts, where we respond to your thoughts and questions. Those posts are open to the public, and we hope you'll come engage and ask questions. You can find it all at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast about a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here with
Keith Phipps,
Tasha Robinson,
and Genevieve Kosky.
This week, we're talking about two movies about a future where androids are so sophisticated they could be mistaken for humans. But before we do, I want to start with a question for the group. If you had a robot, what would you want it to do, Tasha?
I think I would like a cooking robot. Thank you for offering, Scott. That's very kind of you. I'm glad you're going to go out and hook us up with Boston Dynamics. I've always thought that I could probably be a lot healthier if I had a robot in the kitchen making nutritious, healthy meals for me. But I would want that robot to be dual purpose and capable of screening the roughly 12,000 trailers that I get every week for like negligible looking horror movies. I just want it to be capable of like going through and telling me which ones are actually worth my attention, because it's kind of time consuming. Genevieve, what about you? What do you want a robot for?
Well, I think those are both good options, but seeing as I don't really watch horror movie trailers, and I actually would think I would miss the sort of creativity that cooking allows me, I just go straight to the most mundane task that I would happily give up, and that is laundry. Give me a laundry robot. I never want to fold socks again in my life. Scott,
wow.
What about
you? Well, first of all, I want to say, you know, Tasha, they have those like smart ovens now, right? You just have like a bar, you get the food and the mail, and then you just, is this like a barcode that the thing reads? That's kind of like a cooking robot.
I would prefer to not get mail order food. No, I want the robot to go like shop for fresh ingredients too.
I think you just killed all the, like a lot of sponsors by saying that, Tasha. We love mail order food. Please.
I'm sorry, Blue Apron. If you want to give us money and call it a robot.
She's looking forward to our future sponsors, the cooking robots. who will eventually take
when,
over.
When Blue Apron becomes humanity. Chrome Apron, it can call us up and sponsor us.
Well, my robot would have two incredibly specific purposes. One would be to clean the cat box, which I hate to do. You hate to do it. And a robot would not mind, could not smell, but could certainly scoop. That's a pretty basic robot thing. And then also would have to review any Ryan Reynolds movies for the reveal. I've had my fill. I've done a couple of them already, and I'm done. I'm done with them. So scooping the litter box, reviewing Ryan Reynolds movies. Keith, what about you?
Okay, I don't want to sidetrack, but I don't want to write off all Ryan Reynolds. He definitely has had his moments. I just feel like he's coming into the full. Anyway, we'll skip past that. So I've given this some thought. I definitely want a robot who does not look the least bit human or have any human qualities, because I want to avoid all the philosophical issues raised by these movies with my robot. And honestly, I really kind of following your guys' example, I really would like someone to deal with really mundane stuff like actually filtering my email in a way that makes sense, and tidying up my physical media collection and that kind of thing. So I'll take that. I mean, I like to cook. I actually don't mind laundry. I put on a TV show and kind of just do my folding in there, and that's fine with me. But yeah, it's a Roomba 7.1 or something like that. That's what I need. Who also understands how to alphabetize Blu-rays? Then that's perfect. That's my robot.
A robot unpaid intern.
Yes, precisely.
The androids we're talking about in this pairing are not of the bleep bleep variety, but machine learners who have unmistakably human qualities, even if their software has some heartbreaking limitations. Tasha, what do we have on tap?
Well, first up is AI, Artificial Intelligence, a project that started with Stanley Kubrick and ended with Steven Spielberg. It remains a unique fusion of their different sensibilities, even though Kubrick died before AI went into production. Haley Jo Osment stars as a robot who's been programmed to feel love, which gives him a strong attachment to the parents who adopt him. When circumstances change and the robot boy is kicked out of the house, he embarks on a journey to reunite with his human mother. And Pinocchio-like, he wants to become a real boy in the process. We're pairing AI with Koganada's new science fiction film After Yang, which also shows sympathy for an android companion. Only in After Yang, the android dies at the beginning of the film, and it's the human father, played by Colin Farrell, who embarks on a journey, first to fix the android for his daughter, then to simply understand its significance as a being.
So more sophisticated than my litter cleaning robot then. Okay, we'll pick apart the circuitry of AI after the break.
His name is David.
I feel it. That's creepy.
Whoa, just so real.
In a distant future, in an age of intelligent machines, he is the first robotic child programmed to love and coexist as a member of a family. His is a tale of humanity and a journey to find his place among humans and machines.
I'm a boy.
You are a real boy. At least as real as I've ever made one.
One of Steven Spielberg's signature touches as a director are his reaction shots, which invariably come before the audience sees the incredible thing his characters are reacting to. The camera pushes in, or, in the famous shot of Roy Scheider on the beach in Jaws, dollies back and then zooms in, and we look at a mouth that's slightly agape and eyes that are widened in amazement at whatever we're about to see. It could be a shark. It could be a T-Rex. It could be a close encounter of the third kind. But it's part of Spielberg's narrative strategy to raise the stakes by connecting to the human capacity for wonder and vulnerability. With children especially, wonder and vulnerability are two sides of the same coin. Older people don't have the same capacity for either one. We're more cynical and world-weary. Not as much seems new to us, and we're more prepared to withstand the physical and emotional threats the world throws at us. The reason Spielberg's E.T. the Extraterrestrial is one of the all-time great tearjerkers is how well he's able to articulate the needs of a child, which we recognize as our own needs. The need to love and be loved. The need to be protected from danger. The need to have a home. Those needs are literally universal in E.T., to the point where a human boy and an alien from a faraway galaxy are emotionally connected. The Spielberg who directed E.T. is still very much present for AI, artificial intelligence, tapped into another boy who has all the needs of the vulnerable characters in E.T., only he happens to be a robot. The genesis of this project is over 50 years old. A short story by science fiction author Brian Aldiss called Super Toys last all summer long. The story was optioned by Stanley Kubrick, who spent a typical eternity developing the project without ever getting around to making it himself, which happened to a few other Kubrick films that never materialized. Before he died, Kubrick made it clear that he did feel like Spielberg was the person to bring AI to the screen, despite the massive contrast in their sensibilities. Kubrick was the cold clinician behind 2001 A Space Odyssey and A Clockwork Orange. Spielberg was the sentimental maestro behind some of the biggest blockbusters of all time. This contrast is precisely what makes AI so effective, and perhaps so polarizing and open to interpretation. It's a bleak film about human nature disguised as a sentimental science fiction fairy tale, like a dystopian Pinocchio. Haley Joel Osment stars as David, a piece of next-gen technology whose Geppetto is a professor and scientist, played by William Hurt, who has taught him to love. In a 22nd century where climate change has led to a rise in sea levels that's wiped out coastal cities and much of the population, David's new quote-unquote parents, Monica and Henry Swinton, are privileged survivors, but they have struggles of their own. The Swintons are chosen as the perfect family for David because their own son, Martin, has a rare disease and is being kept in a state of suspended animation in the thin hope that a cure will be found. In the meantime, Monica, played by Frances O'Connor, eventually overcomes her repulsion to keeping David as a replacement for Martin, and she warms to him over time. Eventually, she finally moves forward on a process called imprinting, where the android, or Mecha, officially attaches to its owner, and vice versa. The ethics of the imprinting process are a big part of the film. Quote, if a robot could genuinely love a person, what responsibility does that person hold to the Mecha in return? Unquote. Humans would usually say none at all when it comes to machines. In this world, many Mechas, when they become outdated, are hunted down and thrown into demolition shows called flesh fairs. But David is different. And when Martin's return and a terrible accident prompts Monica to discard David in the forest, he sets off on an adventure not only to find her again, but to find a blue fairy that will turn him into a real boy. For some of this journey, he's accompanied by Jude Law as Gigolo Joe, a Mecha who's also on the run, even though he's not as sophisticated an android as David. David and Monica are bonded through routine. All parents can identify with that to some extent, because domestic routines give structure to a child's life. An ordinary day has certain expected parameters. What makes their relationship unusual is that Monica is playing a game of pretend with David. Her real son is gone and may never come back. So to ease the pain of his absence, she has this loyal, perfect boy who can fill in those emotional gaps in her life. But if you fake something for so long, it starts to become real. Spielberg knows how such fantasies work. He's been spinning them for his whole career. The end of AI is its most controversial aspect, with some criticizing Spielberg for engineering a happy ending. But, if anything, it's bittersweet, with the emphasis on bitter. David, Monica, and the entire human species, and the planet at large, have been relegated to obsolescence. They can play pretend just one more time before the lights go out.
Is it a game?
Now, I'm gonna read some words. And, they won't make any sense, but I want you to listen to them anyway. And look at me all the time. Can you do that?
Yes, Monica.
Can you feel my hand on the back of your neck?
Yes.
Does any of this hurt?
No.
Okay, now. Look at me. Ready? Cirrus. Socrates. Particle. Decibel. Hurricane. Dolphin. Tulip. Monica. David. Monica. I wonder if I did that right. I don't.
What were those words for, Mommy?
What did you call me?
Mommy.
So discussion around AI has always been intense, even before the film came out and certainly afterwards. But what about this film evokes such a strong response, and where do you stand on it? Tasha, let's see. I'm just kidding. Let's just jump right into the waters here.
You just want to pull the heart plug right away and bleed out, don't you?
That's right.
I feel like part of the reason the movie inspires such an extreme response is because people just think of Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg as coming from roughly opposite angles of cinema. And to a certain kind of film snob, I think, just knowing that Steven Spielberg finished a Stanley Kubrick movie is like, I don't know, talking about a team up, like a culinary team up between, I don't know, Joel Rubichon and Ronald McDonald. There's just sort of a feeling of, you know,
which
how dare.
Ronald McDonald?
I know you love Ronald McDonald's culinary endeavors, Scott, but try to stay with
I'm
me
just
on
saying,
the metaphor
I'm just saying,
here.
We're talking about two artists here.
I think that there's just a rebellion against that kind of thing. You know, people hold Stanley Kubrick to a certain standard. They put him on a high platform, and there's that feeling of whatever he would have done, it would have been better than this, precisely because we can't have it. You know, it's like Hodorowski's Dune. Like, it's not that anybody necessarily hates Denis Villeneuve's version of Dune, but in their imaginations, the version that they can't have and will never see is like a completely different animal that is something you can like pin expectations on and get excited about. So I feel like maybe that was part of it. But another part of it is, this is a really dense and dynamic movie. There's a lot going on here. And it was just, it was destined to ruffle a lot of feathers, to get a lot of attention for all of the things it's doing visually and conceptually. Like, it's destined to be a divisive movie. It's full of arguments that seem designed to provoke arguments, I think in a really cool way, to be honest. But then you have the tonal shift at the end, which I'm sure we'll get into, which was hugely divisive. And I think just on top of everything else, there's a feeling that anytime you have a movie that centers on a child or an animal in danger, it's going to heighten people's emotions. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on here, I think, that helped heighten the discourse around this movie. For myself, I think I was pretty disaffected with it when I originally saw it. And it landed a lot better for me this time around, for the most part. I was really surprised at the visuals, honestly, how well they've held up over time, how like strange and distinctive and interesting they look, what Spielberg's look at the future looks like in this case. But I also find myself just taking a lot of notes because the movie throws so many things out, so many like conceptual and philosophical and argumentative ideas, so many glimpses at what the future of the human race might look at. And some of these thoughts are just very, very big and very heady. And honestly, I think if I didn't have such a problem with the ending, I would think that this film was an outright masterpiece. I am still processing, I think, revisiting it just because there's so much going on. So I feel like the bulk of the movie gets one grade and the ending for me gets another. But I'm curious how it landed as a whole for other people here.
This film is an outright masterpiece, and the ending is probably one of the best parts of it.
All right, we're going to fight.
We don't have to fight. We can just discuss. I love this movie. I think it's top tier Spielberg, one of the best films of this century. And yeah, I think I get more out of it every time I watch it. This time, just, you know, I love the whole thing. But the opening sequence, from the opening through the "I'm sorry I never told you about the world" is an emotional gut punch for me. And in part because it is, you know, you do have a kid in danger, but I also feel like on a really fundamental level, this is a film that kind of sees emotions and attachments, and maybe even just the idea of humanity itself, as kind of a curse, as a burden that you carry with you, and maybe never really find a way to not to be weighed down by. You know, this is a kid who, this is a being who becomes different and more vulnerable and, you know, more human. But when the moment he bonds with his mother, quote unquote mother, but also, what does that get him? I mean, it gets him a quote unquote lifetime, or many lifetimes if you measure it in human terms, of suffering and want and need. And in the end, he gets a moment in which with the moment he's always wanted, but it's no more real for him than he was for his mother. It's rough stuff. And it's tough stuff too. I think there's a lot to unpack here, and it's, you know, I think it's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, my response to your question, Scott, of what about this film evokes such a strong response was, before Tasha kind of said it much more eloquently in depth that I would have, was just because it's somewhere between 3 to 4 movies in one, and if you don't like any part of any of those movies, it might kind of throw you off. Really, there's 3 big acts here, and they're all very different from each other. And the connective tissue between them is very thematically strong, and we obviously have the Pinocchio motif carrying through it as well. But the tone of those 3 parts all feels so different. The visuals are all so different. It does kind of feel like there's a little bit of maybe whiplash moments throughout this film, that, again, the ending being the strongest one, to the point where I saw this movie when it came out in theaters. I knew I had seen it. I had mental images of it, but I had never revisited it. And coming into this rewatch, I was finding myself second guessing, wait, did I see this movie? I know I remember Haley Joel Osment, but this is not what I was thinking of when I was thinking of AI, you know? So watching it this time and seeing how it fit together was really interesting. And I think I maybe wasn't quite able to hook into the emotion of it as strongly as I might be able to on a rewatch, where I wasn't where I didn't feel so off balance so much throughout the film in terms of the tone of it. But I'll second everything that's been said about the visuals. I loved watching this film. I loved the experience of watching it, even if I did feel a little unmoored at times from what I was seeing. the metaphor I actually came up with when I was talking to my husband about it is, it reminds me of the famous, you Ohioans will appreciate this, the famous wooden roller coaster, The Beast.
Yay, The Beast.
Which is the longest wooden roller coaster in the world. It has all these really cool and boundary pushing for the time elements to it. And it's so cool when you're on and it just keeps going and you never want it to end. But then when you get off, you're like, oh, that was a really bumpy ride. My ass hurts so much. at the end you're like, huh. Okay, that was a lot of movie, you know, and I'm feeling it. So that was kind of my experience of AI. I did enjoy it, but like Tasha, I think I'm still processing it on a emotional level because I was so fixated on trying to track it on a filmmaking level.
The thing about The Beast is it also takes you into the forest, to kind of its own world. You can kind of keep running with this metaphor.
I know.
Wait a minute. Okay, sorry. I'm completely thrown off. I like this. We should bring in more Cedar Point.
No, King's Island.
Whoa, The Beast was King's Island?
King's Island. The superior of the two Ohio State.
I will have none of that.
Absolutely ridiculous.
That.
No one thinks that. Nobody thinks that.
I'm just going to sit over here and be from the East Coast.
Unbelievable.
Y'all do you.
Yeah, we've rapidly pivoted into a
this part of the podcast is going to delight Dan the Bake Jakes, coaster aficionado.
It's
also going to make up for all of the Hello Fresh and Blue Apron sponsors that we lost with the opening, where we're just going to get King's Point to sponsor us from now on.
King's Point, Cedar Point, King's
whatever.
Island. What about Geauga Lake? Do you remember that? It's closed down now. Geauga Lake. Do you remember that? You would have to be 50 years old to remember that. All right. So
one more thing. Was Cedar Point ever featured in an episode of The Brady Bunch? Because the King's Island can make that claim to fame, and I don't think Cedar Point can. Argument settled. Carry on.
This is do you want ants? Because this is how we get podcasts that are longer than movies.
This is a bonus episode to come.
Well, I found this movie to be much like The Screaming Demon. Anyway, now you go up, you go through the around the loop, and then forwards, and then you go backwards through the loop. Actually, I guess that's more like Memento or something. Or anyway, as for my reaction to AI, I think it's all kind of in the keynote, so maybe we don't need to dwell on it that much. I do love this movie. I find that I connect with it more and more every time I watch it. Certainly, you know, I have a particular attachment to it as a father that I did not have back in 2000 and 2001, right? Or 2000 when this came out?
2001.
Yeah. And so there's that. And I also think like this, I think that we're almost kind of catching up with it technology-wise, specifically with this, that idea of imprinting. It almost feels more intuitive to us now, the way we kind of connect ourselves to devices, and those devices are kind of an extension of ourselves, and it's that kind of an idea wasn't really present as much in 2001, and here it's such a strong metaphor. I mean, it's just, you know, just this is the moment that imprinting happens is just one of the many like tear jerking moments in the film for me, of just like the expression, the change in David's eyes at that moment. Just it really is such a key emotional kind of push that this film gives you. And just generally, I find the film to be such a fascinating collaboration between a two very strong visions. I mean, obviously Kubrick wasn't alive, but he's certainly present in the film. And I think that we can also, rather than kind of dreaming of the AI that Kubrick would have made, I think we should acknowledge that there are things that Spielberg can do, feelings that he can evoke, you know, connections that he has to the world of, to fantasy and to children and to, you know, things that are just not in Stanley Kubrick's wheelhouse at all. So I appreciate that the film both feels like a collaboration between the two of them, but also has a kind of a unique tension as well that makes it, I think, complicated in a great way.
I really have to wonder if Stanley Kubrick would have been able to get the kind of performance that we see out of Haley Joel Osment here, given his, you know, pretty famously exhaustive method of dealing with actors versus, yeah. I read a lot of interviews with Haley Joel Osment about working with Spielberg, because I was really curious what his inner life was like making this movie. I thought a lot watching this movie about the interviews that Sarah Polley later gave about working with Terry Gilliam on Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Yeah.
And just like what Haley Joel Osment must have gone through making this film. But he's talked a lot about how Spielberg just basically sat down and they had very intellectual conversations about David's life and David's capabilities and his place in the world. And I can't think that would have been Kubrick's approach. Like, reportedly, one of the reasons that Kubrick couldn't make his version of AI was he just literally did not believe that a child could give the performance that he wanted. Mm. He wanted technology that would let him either build an actual child robot for the role, or like the equivalent of CG, just making a CG character in the role. And the fact that Spielberg brought in Osment and trusted him with this role, I think maybe is a leap that only he could have made. And God, it pays off. I mean, this is a really spectacular acting job for such a young child. And the moment that you called out where the imprinting process is complete and David's eyes change and he goes from that sort of like rigid specter of genial complacence and like intense presence to being almost baffled at the depth of the emotion he feels, that would be a remarkable job for an adult actor to pull off. I was stunned and moved by that, just the expression changing on his face in that moment.
Yeah, I think that was the moment when I turned to Steve and was like, this movie couldn't have existed if Haley Joel Osment wasn't at this age at this exact moment. I feel like it's like, I mean, I'm sure there are other talented actors, but just like, because this was this immediately post Sixth Sense?
'99. I think he did Pay It Forward between those. Yeah.
And yeah, okay. He did.
But I think audiences probably associated him most with Sixth Sense and the uncanniness of that character, which I think probably carried over to how, I mean, I still think of Sixth Sense first and foremost when I think of Haley Joel Osment. And I think a lot of audiences at the time and now probably brought that feeling that he is, you know, a precocious adult in a child body type, you know, that translates really well to David and his performance, which is very good. But with that exception of the moment of imprinting and what Osment does in that moment, the first act of the movie actually feels the most Kubrickian to me, just because of the, I guess, coldness and just how kind of terrible humanity comes across in it. And I think that's where I still have trouble reconciling the ending. And like, I get it, but also I don't really feel it because I spent so much of this movie just feeling like, wow, humans are the worst. We suck. We deserve everything that comes to us in this movie. You know, justice for David. And like the fact that David is in a position where he can't have any sort of, that humans have put him in a position where he can't be whole, is just really maddening, I think, to sit with through the entire movie. So when you reach that resolution at the end, it does feel very pat. And I like your observation, Scott, about like the artificiality of it being, you know, the idea. But I think just in terms of sitting through this movie, when you reach that point, at least for me, it felt very at odds with like the feelings I had toward humans throughout this entire film.
Is it Monica an exception though? I mean, what does Monica do that's
the fact that she imprints on him in the first place? Like, I mean, I guess that's like an Eve in the Garden moment, moment, you know? That's like original sin.
She's a flawed, but I think her actions. She does feel like she does like having him around, and she does.
It's a purely selfish action, though. Like,
it's not even a selfish action. It comes across as ill considered. She spent very little time with him, and most of that time she's spent protesting. And it feels like when she does it, even the garden is a great metaphor for it. It feels more like she's curious than like she's committing. It feels like somebody who brings a bunny home for Easter because she thinks it'll provoke a fun reaction, but is not thinking about the life of that bunny. Like, she's been warned this thing will last forever and will love you forever. And I don't think that there's anything on screen that suggests she's even thought seriously about that commitment and what she's doing.
I actually agree with what you're saying, Tasha. I feel like it's not Monica at the end. It's his idea of Monica, which is better than Monica ever actually could be. It is uncomplicated and paying attention to him and projecting, you know, as much a simulation of love as, you know, reflecting his own idea of love back to him in a way that he needs, but it's not her. It's better than her, at least it's better to him than she ever was.
I don't want to get into the ending yet because there's so much of the film that we should talk about first, and it's such a can of worms. I'm literally just talking about the moment where she chooses to make a permanent decision for someone who has no choice himself, and she does it in what seems like a rushed and cavalier way. I don't think that the movie sets her up as somebody who is ready for this decision or makes it with the kind of thought that it clearly needs, given all the warnings. And I agree with Genevieve. I just think that this movie shows humanity as selfish and short-sighted and consumeristic and greedy and a whole lot of other ugly things.
Well, and even that opening scene with William Hurt where he's like talking about doing this, and he's the one who invokes God and Adam, you know? Like
sure.
This film is literally setting up the idea that humans are playing God here, and they are toying with something that is beyond them. And I think like the Monica imprinting thing could have worked if the whole movie was like just that, you know, but it does happen really fast. Like, it goes from David entering their home and then being like really unnerved by him, and as Tasha pointed out on Twitter today, in this almost like horror movie vibe.
There's no almost. I think the first act is a horror film.
We said the same thing when we were watching it, very much. And again, that's kind of where I get the Kubrick feeling in the first act a lot more. Not that Spielberg can't do that too, but anyway, I digress. And it seems like correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the moment that turns it for her is just like putting him to bed and reading him a story and it reminding her of Martin, and that just doesn't maybe, and also maybe like him laughing at the dinner table, which is like really creepy, and I don't understand why that is supposed to be endearing. But and then all of a sudden, like, okay, she's ready to imprint on him. It just feels like a shift that happens a little too quickly for it to not come across as cavalier on her part.
Monica innocent, but I'm going to make an argument. I'll make an argument for Monica after this break.
Mm-hmm. take this. Don't let anyone see how much it is, all right? Now look, don't go that way, all right? Look! Don't look at me! Look! Don't go that way, all right? Go anywhere but that way or they'll catch you. Don't ever let them catch you. Listen, stay away from flesh fairs, away from there are lots of people. Stay away from all people, only others like you, only Mecca are safe. Now gotta go.
Why do you want to leave me? Why do you want to leave me? I'm sorry, I'm not real. If you let me, I'll be so real for you.
Don't, David. Let go! I'm sorry I didn't tell you about the world.
Okay, so I don't want to close the door on the whole Monica thing yet. because I think that if you are talking about her as Eve in the garden, you associate Eve with sin potentially, but also curiosity. That is the sin. She does not necessarily know the implications of what she is doing. I think there's a degree to which she feels comforted and by the ritual of being a mother is willing to play pretend with this super toy. That's a very human thing. And I think there is something that genuine that does develop between them. And I think her actions from that point forward, with trying to integrate him into the family, with trying to have him be in the family when the son makes his return. And then, of course, the decision to sort of deposit him in the forest. All of that is very rational to me. And her reaction to it is not cold. It's very, it's an incredibly upsetting scene. I think perhaps we can throw much of humanity into the garbage here, but Monica's somewhat innocent for me.
We can agree Martin sucks though, right?
Yeah, he's awful.
Just the kid should have just stayed in suspended animation forever.
And honestly, let's not let Henry off the hook here either, because he probably has the biggest like he's the one who brings it to her in the first place.
Dad quick fix thing, come on, I just, you know, can we be done with this now, this whole
But it's also very much implied, I think, that he's doing it to get ahead at work, that he thinks that this will give him an edge at his job, and he seems to have very little patience with Monica's very real human response at being alone in the house with this incredibly uncanny at first object that's meant to mimic a human child in ways that unnerve her. He really just kind of wants everybody to cooperate and get along so he can get a promotion, it seems like.
I love the detail of David referring to Monica as mommy Henry as Henry.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't happen until after the imprinting, right? Yeah. So
at which point it becomes clear that this robot was apparently designed to imprint only on one person, which in a family, like the fact that it was designed for that specifically is just really telling about how short-sighted and off base the design is, just in terms of how it's supposed to integrate. I don't want to be too harsh on Martin, who does terrible things and terrible things result, but he is, after all, a child, and a child who has been through a tremendous trauma and has been replaced in his absence, and has also very clearly been conditioned, probably by Henry, maybe by society. There's a lot that we learn about this world, I think, through the way Martin speaks of David, you know, his understanding of what Mecca are and how he sees David as just another toy that's been brought home for him that has already obsolesced and is uninteresting the way the teddy bear is to him. So, like, obviously he gets all of our nerves up because he's abusing and damaging this character that we immediately feel for on screen. But he is also just being a little boy, like testing the boundaries and trying to come to terms with a form of sibling rivalry, like a form of jealousy that comes heavily complicated with the fact that the thing in his house that looks like a child is also a toaster, as far as he's concerned, to be very Battlestar Galactica about it.
Well, let's take I wanted to take a step back then, because, you know, maybe this will get us into a little bit of the second act of the film, introduction of Jude Law, and just the world outside of this bubble in which, you know, Monica and David and Henry and Martin are sort of operating in the first third of the film. You know, what do you make of the world of the film as it's revealed through that second act?
Can I, before we transition, and maybe as part of that transition, just call something out that I think is really significant. When Martin comes home, he is wearing an oxygen mask. He's in a wheelchair. He's completely unresponsive. When we next see him, he's wearing artificial robotic prosthetic supports for his limbs. When we see him again after that, the supports are gone, but he's watching other children play with obvious, like, bitter jealousy, because it's very clear that, like, he's not allowed to participate in anything that physically active. The movie never comments on any of this. None of it is spelled out. We're just left to intuit the passage of time and the development of his body after this disease. And as you ask about the world and what we learn about it in the second act, I feel like so much of this film operates on that level. There are so many things that we're just left to intuit for ourselves, to see on screen without anybody explaining to us and spelling things out for us. And I think the world building here is just remarkable, and how much of it is communicated in that kind of way, just through the progression of things happening on screen over time or via progressions from place to place. I really think that a lot of thought went into this that is part of the storytelling in a really subtle way that I just love to see on screen.
The fact that we don't see anyone but elites until we get to the Flesh Fair, and even that's really the only time we see people who obviously don't have a lot of money, is in that segment. I mean, I guess that may not be true of Rouge City. We don't see enough of it to see any details, but, like, you know, blue collar working class people are only seen in that one section, and they are angry and left out. I mean, it felt, you know, a gap elapsed between the first time I saw this and then later. I was like, oh wow, this is like Tea Party people, you know, before that even happened. And the fact that the song that Ministry performs, an industrial band performs, is called What About Us, which is also a line of dialogue from the film. I mean, these are forgotten people. And the film keeps them on the margins, I think, somewhat pointedly too, because this is a world that has been, you know, wrecked for all but people who can't afford to live in the kind of bubble we see early on.
Yeah, and it made clear via some of the dialogue and behavior at the Flesh Fair that these are also people who've had their livelihoods threatened by the arrival of robots, by jobs just being taken away from them and them not having as many options as they used to, even in a depopulated world, even in a world that seems to need people. It's communicated that it doesn't need them. Although I think it's a really interesting touch that, you know, the depiction of blue collar people in films these days can be very fraught and politicized. I think it's interesting here that we're kind of invited to see them as monsters. And then we're immediately, we have a shift where we're invited to note that they have more empathy than a lot of the people on screen who are manipulating them and profiting off of them. They have an immediate empathetic reaction to a child that goes beyond philosophy. They have an immediate protective feeling towards him. And there's just that feeling there of, you know, they may be rough and rowdy, but, like, they've still got a lot more empathy and human feeling than some people in this world.
See, I think that was maybe one moment that kind of felt a little at odds to me with what we've seen, what the movie has shown us so far as humans' relationship to Mecca, where they, you know, rise to the defense of David as a whole. You know, there are no dissenters among them. And to go back kind of to just the depth of the world building here, one of the things I really enjoy about the second act is just the variety of Mecca that we see, and, like, how it illustrates the multiple generations and iterations of this tech that humanity has made and lived with for years, decades at this point. I don't know if we get, like, an exact timeline. But, like, this is a antagonistic relationship that is, like, fomented over years and years, and you can see it in these roving bands of outdated Mecca looking for, you know, spare parts. And so, and the idea of a flesh fair to begin with, And it just, it strikes me as a little too much of a stretch to believe in the context of what we've been shown, that the newest version of this tech that humans have seen improve and displace them over and over and over again, that no one would be alarmed or feared of that simply because it takes the form of a child. Obviously, Brendan Gleeson's character is supposed to be a monster, but someone in that audience presumably shares his feelings, you know? But I think the reason I had that feeling is reflective of the depth of world building in this movie. And just to take a quick step backward to the introduction of Jude Law, I love that 5 minutes we get with Gigolo Joe, just his introduction. And there's a whole movie in there with him being framed for murder and Enrico Colatone showing up very, very briefly. There's a whole Blade Runner movie in there or something. And it's just so, it tells us so much about this particular corner of the mecha universe and how humans interact with it here that is very different from what we've been experiencing for the first act of this movie. And I think in that moment, it just feels like the world opens up in this really exciting way that continues through the Flesh Fair sequence.
As to the Flesh Fair response to David, I just think they don't believe that he's a robot. You know, somebody in the audience screams bots don't plead for their lives. Hmm. I think they authentically refuse to believe that Brendan Gleeson has found a humanoid robot. And in spite of his appeal to their intellect, their baseline feeling is I'm seeing a child being threatened with death. And that's why they stand up for him.
I guess I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think if they really believed he was a robot, their responses probably would be different, as you describe.
But again, no one in the audience believed it.
probably some did, and they just weren't the loudest voices. That's just sort of, that's how mobs work.
I was about to say, angry mobs, it is a literal mob mentality. There's a ton of stuff to talk about with this movie, and maybe we can talk about it through the prism of the ending, because the ending is something that was, you know, maybe the reason why this was as controversial as it was, or just discussed as it was, different interpretations of that ending have a very high range of, so I was curious just to hear what your interpretations of that ending are, on top of what you feel about it. So let's get into that now.
Well, Keith loves it. I hate it. I kind of want to hear first, where do you and Genevieve stand specifically on the ending?
Well, like I said, I think I'm still processing it. I definitely didn't hate it. I think everything up to the resurrection of Monica, or Monica Light, as it were, is,
wow.
Again, feels like another movie, a very interesting movie that I would like to see more of, you know, and the aliens are cool, and I admire the
Not
audacity.
Aliens. They're evolved artificial intelligence.
So really? I had completely forgotten about this, but yeah. Apparently there's a huge debate over that. That was one of the big arguments about the ending. And unless you have evidence that Spielberg came out and specifically said one way or the other, I think it's definitely something that people have felt very, very strongly about on both sides.
I don't know where I settled on it being definitively AI. I just think maybe it works better that way, because I feel so much of it. They're very interested in humanity in the sense of it feels like they're investigating their own origins. And what's valuable to them about David is he knew real humans. I see these as the descendants of David. And I think that's more interesting, even if the ambiguity is there, and that's fine. For me, it's more interesting as this being many generations down the line from David, kind of looking for their own sense of where they come from and perhaps a sense of meaning in a way that suggests that the AI could develop, the idea of humans longing for understanding and AIs need to be loved or to emulate humanity has been resolved in some way in the future. To me, that's the way I see it anyway.
Yeah, and then that's interesting because I was unaware of this ambiguity when I watched it, but I also like my perception of them as aliens came from the exact scene and line that you quote of David being the last to know humans, and I interpreted that more in an anthropological sense, like you know, like this is a different race that is curious about humans, not necessarily like their own history, but I definitely see that argument, and it makes it a lot more interesting for me.
I'll throw in a visual detail that kind of supports it too. When we first see David, it's through like he's like a blurry shadow, but the blurry shadow is more or less the same shape as the creatures, whatever we call them, that we see at the end.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I think there is an ambiguity there that Spielberg doesn't spell out and that you're allowed to read either way. And I don't think on some level that it matters, at least not in a way to fight about. I think all interpretations are valid here. I think it is clear that they're mechanistic creatures of some kind. And I think it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other, whether they're specifically descended from Earth robots or they're robots that evolved in a like on a parallel planet. I think that what's significant is really their empathy for machine life. And I think that that's just a really interesting touch that shapes the whole thing. And exactly what the intent of that is in terms of whether it comes more of a curiosity about their roots or curiosity about another species that's gone, I think is beside the point. The point is that they have more of an intellectual curiosity and sympathy than the actual living humans we've seen throughout the film for the most part. You know, they're benevolent. And whether they're benevolent aliens or benevolent robots or benevolent robot aliens, the point is that they're not humans. They're on some level like better, you know, smarter, kinder, and certainly more capable of sharing. The sequence where one of them takes David's memories and is examining them, and each of them just sort of steps up to touch the next one in line and form a chain, and they all share those memories. Again, like storytelling without explaining, and it's just a beautiful, compact visual that kind of tells a lot about these things, community and their level of interest in things and their ability to just kind of all live in the same space. I don't know. I find it fascinating and just kind of a further iteration of, you know, Spielberg's obvious interest in alien life, if you take Close Encounters as an example.
In E.T., I mean, I think there's an idea in both in E.T. and in Close Encounters of you know, we of course respect the intelligence of non-human beings to travel through space and that sort of business, but there's an emotional intelligence that Spielberg kind of locks on to as well, a different type of an enhanced, you know, empathy, I guess, that they perhaps are better than the sort of messy lot of humanity, but in a way, like that element of it, the setup of that, it's just not, it doesn't resonate with me as much as just the ritual part of it. I just, and again, in terms of, you talk about a film sort of changing over time, what I lock into, or changing for me over time, is like, you know, I really lock into how the ending sort of mirrors in it, you know, in a, maybe it's a distorted way, that the first third, the rituals of parenthood and how those are imbued with meaning. Because I mean, again, when you're in the middle of it, I mean that's what parenting is. It is about just routine, and if you find some sort of comfort and meaning in those routines and little breaks in those routines, and that's what it is, what that relationship is. And to see that kind of like day in the life be both normal, like quote unquote normal, and also kind of idealized in a way that's slightly and almost sort of touchingly false, that gets to me so much. And just also, you know, getting to this point, you know, where everything that we've built here, you know, humanity itself, the planet, our all of our, you know, the structures, I mean, everything's gone. You know, it's just like that. It just feels like this. It's such a lonely moment. It's such a bleak moment. Even though I think you could also, even though I think I was read as kind of Spielberg, throwing kind of a Hail Mary pass of sentimentality at the end of a bleak movie. I don't feel like that's it at all. I feel like it's, like I said, on the bitter side of bittersweet.
Well, Spielberg talked about also, how...
It like, factually, that isn't true. So, I know that that's something that people have said about it a lot, but, Spielberg's done interviews about this, and he said, like, that whole ending is 100% Kubrick. It's straight out of Kubrick's script. He says a lot of the darkest stuff in this movie came from him himself, and a lot of the stuff that people tagged as Spielbergian sentimentality, including the entire ending, is pure Stanley Kubrick. Now, I think all of it would have played differently directed by Stanley Kubrick, but you certainly can't say, as so many critics did in print in the day, that this is like an artificial ending that he imposed after the real Kubrick version ended underwater at the end of time.
To me, it's quite bleak. I mean, I think it goes beyond bitter and bittersweet. I think what you get is this, although the creatures do talk about being able to resurrect humans, it's not going very well. It's not entirely successful, but I feel like what we're getting with this David interacting with some version of his mother, I mean, it's like in the darkness that humanity has become, it's like one last match has been found and it's lit, and then it just kind of blows out, and that's the end, not just of David's story, but of our own.
Well, let me tell you where my objections with the ending lie, and then you can tell me if these are things that just read very differently for you. I love the staging of it. I love the idea of these anthropological aliens or robots or alien robots showing up and exhuming the past and just kind of exploring what humanity used to be. I think there's just an elegiac quality to the whole thing that's very aesthetically pleasing and also poetic. I love the design of the aliens. I love the design of their ship. That moment where the ship kind of touches down in the frozen underwater excavation and then just like comes apart into component pieces and drifts away is just a lovely little bit of lyrical storytelling. There's so much there that I like. And Ben Kingsley as the specialist robot sitting down with David and explaining, like, we love you and we want to give you whatever you want, I think is very touching. But the shape of the fantasy just really inherently bothers me. And that's because while it parallels the beginning in terms of here's a little domestic scene where there are two people wrapped around each other and one of them has been programmed to love the other one, just completely and totally without any outside interference. The thing that's been programmed in the final sequence is a person and used to be a person and is now this thing whose life and autonomy has been taken away, who has been basically the truth is being hidden from her because it might frighten her. Her husband and her child and her past and future have been taken away. All context has been taken away. All she's allowed to do is exist for this child. And I see where that is meant to be like a mirror reversal of the opening. But you aren't talking about something that's been invented to love. You're talking about something that used to be human and isn't anymore. And I find it, again, it's kind of a horror movie. And if I take it as a horror movie ending that's meant to be beyond bleak, I can almost accept it. But the way the movie treats it as this sentimental thing that David gets to experience that's perfect, I find it unnerving and just it leaves a really bad taste in my mouth.
I mean, I guess I would say that you would use the word unnerving. I mean, I don't see how that's an accident, I guess.
Yeah, are we meant to see it as unnerving, or are we sentimental and sweet?
Yes. No, I think you're reading it as sentimental and sweet, but feeling unnerved by it. And I think that's the exact reaction
But I think she's unnerved by it on a storytelling level and finding it sentimental on a filmmaking level, which again kind of brings us back to the Spielberg of it all, because I agree with Tasha. I did have kind of like a visceral distaste of the ending watching it and listening, like sitting through this conversation and talking it out. Like, I definitely do feel better about it just on a sort of narrative level, but I still can't shake that feeling that it wasn't sold to me that way by the film didn't present it to me that way on a visual tonal level.
And the storytelling voiceover, the kind of treacly music, the soft lit, soft focus cinematography, like they're all presenting a sentimentalized version of what we're getting. But what we're getting is the lobotomization of a woman and the death of a child presented as a storybook ending. Like, a sad and ironic storybook ending, but a storybook ending.
Which honestly does fit with the Pinocchio of it all. Like, we when Pinocchio was a movie of the week back at the Dissolve, we kind of dug into like kind of what a horror story the original Pinocchio is and how it's kind of like been storybookized over time. And we see the visualization of that storybookification in the Blue Fairy at Coney Island, which that paint really held up under the ice all those years.
Right? She also was like covered in like seaweed 2,000 years ago, but like it's completely pristine now.
I think if we want to pull back the camera a little bit, I mean, it is in some ways a film about the stories we create to give meaning to life. And if you pull back a little bit further, if I'm not mistaken, is the narrator not also the voice of the creature voiced by Ben Kingsley? So in some ways, these are the if I'm not mistaken, then it could be read as one of these alien/AI whatever, you know, telling us this story. This is the story that they've formed around what they know of David's life. I mean, it is, you know, there's kind of a, maybe we thought we were looking at the frame, but there's actually a frame beyond that, and it is this, you know, entity, whatever we want to call it, telling the story all along, because he's also there at the beginning of the film and only at the beginning and the end.
I mean, wow. If we're meant to take the whole thing as like a fairy story that aliens are telling themselves to put a happy gloss on this tragic and terrifying tale of soulless humans and soulless love, then like that's a pretty sophisticated, dark joke for this entire movie.
Yeah.
But I'm mostly just talking about what I feel when I'm watching it.
I love that reading of it, even if it is mine, and even if it's my own eccentric thing. I really do feel like it fits the tone of the movie.
I'm really convinced, like you guys being Keith and Scott mainly, but also Tasha in kind of a roundabout way, you are kind of bringing me around on this ending. And I will say that I think if it had done things in a tonally different way and kind of committed to the bleakness and the unsettlingness of that ending on a tonal level as well as a narrative one, I think people would have disliked it even more. it may have been an even more controversial ending. And the Pinocchio thing is really kind of what is convincing me that it is purposeful. And, you know, I think if any two filmmakers were going to kind of come up with that sort of tension, it would be these two.
I think it's significant that we literally could talk through practically any sequence in the movie at this level of depth, just questioning like what we're seeing and what we're feeling and how the story is being told. There's so much to this movie, and we've barely even scratched the surface. I really think this could be 5 hours long.
We haven't tried to unpack Gigolo Joe or Teddy. Teddy, who I find a completely fascinating character.
Teddy's our Jiminy Cricket character. It took me a while to figure that out.
But honestly, Gigolo Joe also has like very Jiminy Cricket vibes, especially in the way that he moves through the movie physically.
And the way that he brings music into the movie.
Yeah,
he's I've seen him described as the Lampwick character, but you know, he's not leading him away from morality. He's helping him in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think
the goldfish, actually.
I think the Jiminy Cricket role kind of gets split here. It's not a very exact parallel. Although I really do like the image of Rouge City as Playland in the book or Pleasure Island in the Disney movie. I think that there are like a handful of fun parallels, including just the fact that he dives underwater and runs across a big fake whale and just sort of sails by it. But even in the Pinocchio story, Pinocchio does get to be a real boy. You know, he strives and he suffers, and he gets the reward because it's a morality tale. And here, what does he get? He gets something that's not just fake, but that's horrifying in the parameters of what he's been created to want. And maybe the lesson here is just that our idea of love as humans, the way we see it, maybe is inherently flawed in a way that's selfish. It kind of feels like that's what this movie is saying, is that we're so incapable as humans of experiencing love that isn't corporatized, that isn't for sale, that isn't limited to a world where, again, I just obsess over the lines. You know, there was no Martin. There was no Henry. There was nothing in his way. There was nothing for her to do. There was just him. Like, that's a horrifying vision of love.
Well, we should have done a three-part AI podcast.
I was actually thinking, like, if any movie could sustain one of those minute-by-minute podcasts, this would be a very good one.
Hey, write in if you want us to do it. We'll do this, a second podcast just dedicated to this film.
This movie's only 2.5 hours long. It'll, you know, we do one of these a day. It'll only take us most of a year.
So, while we would love to hear your thoughts on this discussion, and particularly if you have some thoughts on the ending, can help us solve that. You can also write us about anything else in the world of film. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net if you want to share those responses with us and other listeners. You know, we are doing Feedback Fridays up on our Patreon, and you know that we would love to dig even more into AI. You could probably get full essays from all of us in response. But we'll be back in a minute with a preview of our next episode. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll compare AI with another film about a sophisticated android companion, Koganada's After Yang. That film is currently playing in some limited theatrical venues and is streaming on Showtime. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, including letters from other listeners, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. We're eager to answer your feedback on Feedback Friday and have recently talked about the ambiguities of The Power of the Dog and given advice on a glorious career in film criticism. We're also at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, get some sleep and go to that place where dreams are born.
What the hell does that mean?
Take the straight and narrow path, and if you start to slide, give a little whistle. You give a little whistle. Woo-hoo! And always let your conscience be your guide.